Good afternoon. It is 4:18 Wednesday, October 16th. This is the TDN Writers Room podcast. I'm Joe Bianco, associate editor at the Thoroughbred Daily News.
I'm Bill Finley, a correspondent for the Thoroughbred Daily News and a devout Boston Red Sox fan.
Alan Carrasso, managing editor of the TDN.
Brian DiNato, racing editor at the TDN and managing partner of Franklin Ave Equine.
So we're going to start this podcast with a little bit of an update on some star horses and what their plans are going forward. The big headline that the takeaway of this week is Enable, who will not be coming for the Breeders' Cup turf, but will be staying in training. It's not 100% that she's going to run in 2020, but she's going to stay in training if she is doing well. The expectation is that she's going to run next year, with the goal being a third arc. It's obviously good for racing, and it's an important thing to have these superstars staying around. Personally, I think I got to give a lot of credit to the Zayats, because I feel like there was a trend of horses retiring early when they didn't need to. And when they kept American Pharoah around after he won the Triple Crown, when they easily could have retired him, I think a lot of people expected him to be retired, and they ran him in the Haskell, in the Travers, and then in the Breeders' Cup Classic. I think that signaled to a lot of people that these horses are worth more to the sport necessarily than they are, you know, on the racetrack or in the stallion farm. I think it was a big deal that kind of international superstar stuck around, and I think that's started to reverse the trend at least a little bit. And Enable hanging around, I think there's become more of a felt obligation, I think, for people who own great horses, who have these massive followings and these international superstardom profiles, to keep them around. What do you guys think?
Well, first of all, you showed your age there, because how young you are compared to an old grizzled veteran like myself. And I agree with you what you said about Zayat, and especially after Justify, you know, said call it a day after the Belmont Stakes. But remember that Seattle Slew and Affirmed, so they're two Triple Crown winners, and then Spectacular Bid, who, you know, really was worthy of being a Triple Crown winner. They came back as 4-year-olds in the 70s, and then, you know, we had the big gap of no Triple Crown winners. So, you know, I guess that's how much the game has changed. It would be, you know, no one would ever dream of bringing a Triple Crown winner back as a 4-year-old, I guess. But look, I mean, it's great. Enable's going to run as a 6-year-old. Now, it's easier to bring a mare back than a stallion, you know, because they're not nearly as valuable. So, you know, you have to temper your enthusiasm with that. But, you know, I hope this is a message for Americans that, you know, it's, think about the sport sometimes, and, you know, how great it would be to see some of these big stars come back. I mean, wouldn't you have loved to seen Justify in the Breeders' Cup and the Travers and everything, and, you know, what that would have meant for the sport. But, you know, at the same, then I understand the economics of it as well. Mm-hmm.
I wouldn't say that mares are necessarily easier to keep around, and certainly, like, who knows what Enable's value would be on the open market, you know, 7-8 figures, who knows.
But, Alan, do you think she's as valuable as, let's just compare, do you think she's as valuable as Justify? I don't, but.
No, of course not.
Right. Yeah, I mean, they have the ability to sell and make a good chunk of money back. You know, it's impossible to quantify exactly what she's worth. I mean, she's a homebred product, and she'll be bred, and so, and maybe that's the reason that they're willing to keep her in training. You know, that her protus is probably not going to come to market, and they can do it like that. I think it's great. You know, if she makes it back to the races, one thing that's interesting is that there is a $1 million race over 2,100 meters, mile and 5/16 on that Saudi Arabia Cup program. It would be interesting to see if that figured in their calculations at all.
I think from Prince Abdullah's perspective, obviously it makes sense. I mean, I think he's 82. If he were to just retire Enable and breed her, chances are you're not going to get another horse like her bred out of her anyways. You know, why not run her for another year? And like Alan said, it's highly unlikely that she'd be sold anyways. So it's exciting that we might get to see her again.
I have a question that, do you think it makes it more likely for turf horses to be able to stick around because it's a more forgiving surface, because it's a less dangerous surface, I kind of feel like in the back of my mind with these Triple Crown horses having to continue to run on this demanding surface, that it becomes more of a risk to your investment than a turf horse. That's just my theory. Does anybody have anything to say about that?
Well, I'm going to take what you said and kind of angle off in a little bit different direction. It's easier in America for turf horses to stick around males because they're not nearly as in demand as dirt horses as sires. Now, that's kind of strange to say that because, you know, there's been this radical shift to more and more turf racing in the United States. But, you know, I don't think anybody goes to the sales looking to buy the next Arlington Million winner. They go to the sales looking to buy Nod to Chicago for you, Alan. They go to the sales. Everybody wants the same thing. They want the next Kentucky Derby winner. So, you know, now Bricks and Mortar, it would be interesting. You know, he's five, but he had a big gap in his form. And when they sent him to the sidelines, he wasn't good enough to be a stallion prospect at that point. But, you know, there's a horse. Would he even come back as a six-year-old next year? I mean, how much would he be in demand as a stallion? So, yeah, I mean, that does relate a little bit to Enable. But, you know, I think Alan hit it right on the head, or Brian, I'm sorry, that, you know, Prince Abdullah is 82. And, you know, hey, I'd run under seven. I mean, why not? Mm-hmm. Like you said, I mean, you're not looking at this from a financial standpoint. The man doesn't need any money, obviously. And, you know, get a foal, just like Brian said. I mean, we hope that he's still around, but, you know, there is that question of when the foal comes to the races, if he's still, you know, he'd be, what, 85, 86 years old. I good for him. I mean, you know, to go against conventional wisdom with this. But, you know, I'm kind of bouncing all over the place, but I did want to make that point about, you know, the value of turf horses in general versus the value of turf horses, at least in the North American scheme of things, so far as their value as racehorses. So, you know, maybe we need another John Henry who's not a gelding to come around, you know, that can would be a great racehorse and won't be viewed at as worth, you know, $1 zillion as a stallion. You know, maybe they would run that kind of horse at 6 years old or something.
I just think there's slight trend in the direction of owners seeing these superstars as the people's horse as much as their horse. And I think that's something that the Zayats, like I said, harped on a lot with American Pharoah, that he belonged to the people, he belonged to the fans as much as he belonged to them. And I think that's kind of what they did with Winx too. You know, they ran Winx a lot. They could have retired her a lot earlier, but she belonged to the people in Australia, and she was immensely popular. And they, you know, I mean, they were rewarded obviously with lots of purse money, but I think they were rewarded by seeing the impact that their horse had on the everyday racing fan. And I think that's kind of what factors into these decisions sometimes, more so than maybe than it did before.
And Beholder as well. I mean, as much credit as we want to pay to the Zayats, you know, I think BYU News is due a giant amount of credit for keeping Beholder in training through her six-year-old campaign. And, you know, and to keep her, I think trainers would say that it's difficult to keep fillies or mares fresh and keep their minds in the game, and they cycle and maybe they want to become moms. But again, to do the job that Mandela did with Beholder, another phenomenal job. And she too was something of a people's horse.
Mm-hmm. Joe, I think we have to sort of table this discussion and enter our opinions until we see the next three-year-old superstar come around. You know, nobody out of this year's three-year-old class is just, you know, is ready to, with a possible exception of Omaha Beach, if he does something special in the next couple months. Nobody in this three-year-old class is going to be much, you know, in great demand as a stallion. So, you know, Code of Honor probably would be the most valuable, I would think. So I think you're going to see the Triple Crown horses all come back next year. But, you know, if we get another Justify, if we get another American Pharoah, what will be their direction they will go in? You know, we'll even get that horse to race beyond the Belmont. You know, so I think, you know, whether or not the tide has sort of shifted or not, I don't think we can answer that until the next, you know, horse comes around that is going to be the gold standard for stallions and is just going to be, you know, worth unfathomable amounts of money. You know, we'll get that horse maybe next year, maybe the year after, something like that. And then we can better judge, you know, if in fact the sport has turned a corner in that regard. I mean, as fans, which we all are in this room, we all sure hope that it does. But, you know, I'll believe it when I see it.
I mean, I brought up American Pharoah because he is well bred, but besides the breeding, the attraction of having the first Triple Crown winner in a million years, I think that was enough for anybody else to really take that horse off the track and cash in. So I think, you know, whether or not the pedigree is 100% immaculate or whatever, I think that was a good example of owners feeling an obligation to deliver the horse that the people want to see. And that's how you get people to return to the track, is names that they recognize and they want to show up and see them run. So I agree that there isn't 100% of a noticeable trend, but I think it is starting to go in that other direction, where for a long time, it seemed like as soon as a horse won the Derby or a big Triple Crown race, they were beginning to whisk off to the breeding shed. And you brought up Omaha Beach. So I wanted to follow up. Bill has a story in today's TDN about Omaha Beach's plan. He's going to stay in training after the Breeders' Cup. Talk to Rick Porter. The idea is to run him in a Breeders' Cup sprint and then the Malibu and then the Pegasus. He said he wants to go after the three-year-old championship horse of the year and the sprint championship, which I think is a little ambitious. But what did you think?
Well, first of all, it's good to see because, you know, again, here's a horse that they could have pulled up his plug on his career after the Breeders' Cup. I mean, he's already signed the deal with Spendthrift for him to stand there. And, you know, they look at it as if, look, you know, the horse has run three times this year. You know, Breeders' Cup will only be his fourth. We're just getting started. And, you know, the Malibu is a perfect spot for him. And, you know, then so let's end with the Malibu because that's the end of the year. He said that forget about Horse of the Year, that without running the Breeders' Cup Classic. This is from Rick Porter from Fox Hill Farm, the owner. But, you know, if he wins the Breeders' Cup Sprint, and there's, you know, tons of ifs here. I mean, can he really beat Mattioli and those horses?
I don't think
yeah.
so.
But anyways, if he were, you know, let's just treat ourselves to the hypothetical situation would be so exciting. If he does win the Breeders' Cup Sprint, followed up by the Malibu, is he three-year-old champion? I think probably yes.
That's the one of three that I think he has the most realistic chance at.
Yeah.
I think it depends on what Code of Honor does, obviously.
Yeah,
he wins the
true.
Classic,
yeah.
And I mean, you know, I think the Classic would still carry more weight.
Yeah. Also, another update that Bill had today, Bricks and Mortar. So we went back and forth about what race he was going to be in. He's leaning towards the Breeders' Cup turf. I personally think that's the right decision for him. My feeling is that in the mile, you either have to have speed or you have to have like a big closing kick. And I don't think he has either of those. I think he's more of a grinder. And that's why I think he's more successful going 9 to 10 furlong. So I think in the Breeders' Cup turf, even if it's a little bit beyond his purview distance wise, I think he probably has the right style for it to get that stalking one run trip and get a jump on the closers. I think that's probably the right move. But what do you guys think?
I think that makes sense. I mean, especially over that course that tends to play pretty firm. It's not going to be as testing as it might be somewhere else. And like you said, I think he probably has the right running style to maybe get a jump on the best Euros. And, you know, I'm sure Chad can get him to go a mile and a half.
And obviously without an Able, I think it also becomes a little bit more attractive, even though you were trying to beat her, you monster.
There's always next year.
Yeah. Well, you know, it. I thought this was the direction they were going to go in all the time. I mean, you know, he's playing it close to the cuff, and he wouldn't. I just exchanged a couple of texts with Chad, and, you know, he wouldn't be definitive. First thing he said was, you know, they're going to enter in both races. And so that leaves his options open. But, you know, when the guy says at this point, you know, we're close enough to the Breeders' Cup that I think a trainer knows what he's going to do. Mm-hmm. You know, they just want to be careful, extra careful about what they say. So I'll take the leaning, quote unquote, leaning toward the turf is a very good sign. I mean, you can't say 100%, but I guess it's 85% sure that that he'll run in the turf. They'll probably make him the first preference for the turf. Remember, you have to designate what your first and second preference is. And yeah, I mean, there's nothing about this horse that you look at him and say, oh, no, he'll never go a mile and a half. And, you know, even though he's 3 for 3 at a mile, you know, what they need is a mile and a quarter turf race, yeah. But they don't have it. So, you know, turning back in distance, I agree with what Alan said. You know, you would scratch your head a little bit and say, is this horse really got the right running style for this race? Whereas for the mile and a half, I mean, I don't think you'll hesitate even for a second, you know, between the horse's ability, his breeding, and the Chad Brown, you know, magic. You know, you're talking about one of the greatest, even though he's so young and been in the game so briefly, you're literally already talking about one of the greatest trainers that ever lived. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I can't believe that he can't find a way to get this horse to run its A race at a mile and a half.
I think, too, if you put 14 horses in the gate for the mile, I think 14 is what they run, and you draw 13 or 14, you know, your life just got difficult, although it's been done.
Caraconti.
Caraconti. Six perfections. Like, I guess you have to be a Flaxman horse in order to do that. you know, I messaged somebody 6 months ago and said, is it possible that this horse goes in the Classic? Now, he's not going in the Classic. We know that. My feeling the entire time is that this is a true mile and a quarter horse. And if you were ever going to try it, you know, they could have given some consideration to trying him, obviously, by a sire that can get dirt runner that ran well in the Classic himself. I wanted the horse to go to Japan and run the Tenno show, Bill. Mile and a quarter on
damn,
firm turf.
Damn, I was just so open for that, too. Kept me up awake at night.
Mile and a quarter on firm turf. That's exactly what he wants.
Yeah.
Or Hong Kong. We can take that, too.
Of course.
In any event, I do think that the turf is the more preferable of the two races, even if it's not perfect.
Now, do we think if he, let's say he wins the turf, Midnight Bizou wins the Distaff, Code of Honor wins the Classic, who's horse of the year?
Well, it's funny. I just changed my mind. In the first week, I voted in the Ontario poll. I don't know if any of you other guys do. I had Bricks and Mortar on top all year long. And I, now, damn, I wish you, I knew you were going to ask that because I don't have all the numbers written out. If they both finish undefeated, I looked at their records and said, okay, I believe, don't hold me to this. Because I said I didn't bring my notepad, but I believe they would both have five grade one wins on the year. The difference would be Midnight Bisou would have started eight times, and Bricks and Mortar would have started only six. So if they're all things being equal, if they both have, you know, the stamp of being undefeated through the year, if neither one is out of the clamor divisions that usually get horse of the year being male dirt three or male dirt four and older, why wouldn't, you know, there's, how do you split the hair between the two? And I said, well, wait a minute, you know, this horse ought to be, you know, in this day and age, starting eight times is like huge. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the horse campaigned all year long. And I just think that was the difference to me. Now, of course, you know, if one loses and the other wins, you know, then it's a no-brainer. You just go with whichever one wins. But, you know, I mean, I don't think Midnight Beast is going to lose the Distaff. And, you know, Bricks and Mortar probably won't lose the turf. I mean, they'll both be heavily favored in those races. But, you know, I thought they should be rewarded for a full and lengthy campaign in a day and age where eight starts really is a big deal.
I think Midnight Bizou is more of a lock in the Distaff.
Yeah,
just because
I definitely agree.
She's already beaten most of the horses that she's going to be facing. Bricks and Mortar, in addition to the distance question, is likely going to have to deal a couple of salty euros, even if Enable's not coming. So, interesting discussion to be had. I honestly feel like I can't wait for the Breeders' Cup because we're having these hypothetical discussions every week. I want some damn clarity in these divisions.
I mean, for me, I have a vote. Midnight Bisou's campaign, while brilliant, does not include or does not match up with those of Rachel or Hop de Grasse or Zeri. So
I agree.
I couldn't cast a vote for her.
Yeah, but Alan, you know, to be devil's advocate, though, I mean, she's not running against Rachel Alexander and Zeri and Harvey Grace. You just have to judge her against what the competition is.
Yeah.
So, I mean, you're absolutely right. You know, if they went in the Breeders' Cup Classic and won it or something, which was never even under discussion, then, you know, you put her in that category. But, you know, if she has the best credentials of everybody else, you know, I think you have to just go based on that.
See, that's what makes it tough for me. Having never faced open company this year, I guess I'd give it to Bricks and Mortar of the two of them. I still don't know.
Wow.
If Code of Honor wins by five, I'm not saying he will, is he horse of the year? I know he got put up in the Jockey Club.
Yeah.
He lost the Derby, but I mean, I think you can make a serious case for him.
I think he would have to have Midnight Bizou and Bricks and Mortar both not win their races. Mm-hmm. But yeah, he definitely would have a chance if that were the case and he won the Classic. All right, we're going to move on now. It's a story that was in the TDN last week by Dan Ross. I thought it was kind of interesting. We touched on it earlier in the podcast, but wanted to mention that these counter protests and these rallies that are happening in Santa Anita or outside Santa Anita. One interesting wrinkle in Dan Ross's article that we didn't have reported previously is he says that a lot of the people who are on the ground are saying that they are getting these events and these rallies are getting the PETA protesters to show up in smaller and smaller numbers. Now, I assume that'll pick up again at the Breeders' Cup. I'm sure there'll be a ton of protesters. But the reason I think that's significant is that, you know, the only way to resist action is counteraction. And I think when it's the people who are most intimately involved with the horses, I think that that's powerful, because it's one thing for the owners and the blue bloods to talk about how great racing is for horses. It's another thing for the people who have the hands on the horses every single day to have that counter argument. And I think it's the kind of issue where there's a lot of nuance, because there are a lot of things that racing can do better to protect the animals and to protect the athletes. But at the same time, the answer isn't to ban the entire sport. So there's a lot of nuance in between there. And the problem is, when you don't have an effective rebuttal, that leaves space for extremism. When you don't have anybody to explain the nuance, then extremism takes up all that space. And I think that's kind of what's happened with Santa Anita until the backstretch workers and the trainers started rallying and started showing a united front. So I think this is a significant thing. And I wanted to bring it up one more time, because if that is true and they are getting the protesters, the PETA protesters, to back off a little bit, I think that's a worthy example for the rest of racing on how to treat this thing.
I totally agree. And, you know, the thing that's been missing from this whole discussion since the terrible problem that began at Santa Anita earlier this year was, who's telling the other side of the story? And, you know, up until these guys came around, the backstretch workers, really nobody was. And, you know, I think it's just a small kernel, something that should grow. And, you know, I'd like to see, you know, Dan said there was only like 60 people there, and he didn't make that in a derogatory sense. I took that as, well, you know, why aren't there, I mean, how many backstretch workers are there, would you guess? I mean, gotta be well over 1,000. I mean, you know, why weren't there 300 or 400 of them there? But, you know, that's not to criticize, because, you know, thank goodness they are doing something. And, you know, but to me, it's only step one in the process of how do we get our message out and drown out the hyperbole and draconian screams from the other side. So, you know, God bless them. They're doing a great job. And, you know, I think it is more effective than, you know, having B. Wayne Hughes picket or protest outside Santa Anita, because, you know, nobody's going to feel sorry for a multimillionaire or even like a Bob Baffert or something like that. You know, they're a lot more sympathetic that, you know, look, you know, this is how we survive and how we make our livelihoods. And, you know, you're going to literally throw us out on the streets if you ban racing here. So, yeah, you know, kudos to them. And I just say, you know, 60, let's get 600 out there.
Mm-hmm. I think it'll be interesting to see what happens at the Breeders' Cup. I'm sure Pete's got something planned or, you know.
It's going to take me a half hour to get to the gate.
Right.
Waiting through these people.
Well, you know, I don't mean to hog the conversation, which I have been accused of, by the way.
That's unfairly
so.
Never, Bill.
But I'll.
Bill's hosting in a couple weeks, by the way,
since
so watch
you,
out.
You guys seem to not have a lot. I'll make up for it in the Rising Star section. I can't. Well, possibly. I have nothing to do with that. So, you know, I'm not going to say, like, oh, why didn't you make XYZ a Rising Star, you know, when he broke his bane by 16.
Yeah, you've never done that before.
Yeah, parks, yeah. Anyways, I think, though, this whole situation shows one of the great weaknesses in racing is that there is no spokesman. There is nobody as the face of the sport. And, you know, that goes back to the whole idea that people have been talking about for 25 years of we should have a commissioner, which is never going to happen. But it's the fact that we don't have leads to problems like this. And an analogy that I gave you earlier, Joe, was imagine it could actually happen. Imagine if people start picking outside NFL games and say the NFL should be banned because, you know, of the head injuries. And this is a serious problem for the NFL as it is. And, you know, I don't know if it'll ever come to people calling for the ban of football, but it might. You know, Roger Goodell would throw a press conference and, you know, rebut this and get the message across that the NFL is, you know, look at all the rules they've changed and they've tried to come up with safer helmets and get their side of the story out there. And, you know, aside from these backstretch workers, And again, God bless them, but it's not good enough. Mm-hmm. You know, maybe the jockey club should stand up and say something. You know, that's the closest thing I think we have, or maybe the NTRA or something, you know, Alex Waldrop, but it doesn't quite have the clout of, you know, the real commissioner of racing. But, you know, I still feel that we need more of a response from people within the sport to say, look, you know, this is BS. You know, you can't ban the sport. You know, it would be cataclysmic to the, you know, to something that is a vital part of the California economy and, you know, is steeped in history and all that. And, you know, we got the message. We have woken up. And, you know, we can't guarantee you that no horses live or die, but we can guarantee you that, you know, we're going to do everything in our power to make sure that as few as possible.
Yeah, and I think that's like the, I think the positive of this is that safety and horse breakdowns and preventing them might not have always been on the forefront, and now they are. And that's a good thing. I think that's indisputably a good thing. Nobody wants horses to die. Nobody wants fans to come and watch that screen go up. It's a horrible, horrible thing. It's never going to be a 0% fatality rate, but we could have done so much more as an industry in the previous decades. So I think there is a positive to take from that. But again, like you said, Bill, unless you are getting the message out about what we're doing to improve the situation, I think people aren't going to tell the difference, aren't going to be able to tell the difference between now and those eras.
And the overwhelmingly negative stories dominate, obviously. It's what sells. And so I think from the perspective of the people that actually have their hands on the horses, to tell that story and to make that public, you know, to create or generate a public awareness of that, I think that can only be helpful. Because certainly the notion that these horses are abused and they're used for capitalist purposes only, I mean, these owners and trainers and grooms and hot walkers, they all have a vested interest. This is their livelihood. And so for that side of the message to come out is utterly important. We ran in our In Other News section in Tuesday's paper, we ran an op-ed or a letter to the editor from Jim Gagliano that appeared in the New York Times. And the curious part about it, and I mean, I can't imagine that he's the one that generated this headline, but the headline is horses need to be treated better, but scrapping racing entirely isn't the answer. I don't know who wrote that headline. I'm going to assume it came from the Times News.
Yeah, it would not be Jim. That's not right. How it works. It's somebody, an editor at the Times would have written that.
So, the gist of the letter to the editor was good and called out, you know, those people who take horse racing to task. You know, I thought the headline was kind of unnecessarily misleading. But a small attempt from a governing body to address the issue. Mm-hmm.
Well, I hate to even bring this up because it's a subject that is so troubling that I think that, you know, nobody wants to even talk about it. But the elephant in the room that is horse racing is what happens if a horse breaks down at the Breeders' Cup. Can the sport survive that? I shouldn't say the sport. Can California racing survive that? I'm not sure that it can. And it's you know, I know we talked about this on an earlier podcast, whether they should have gone back to San Anita or not, which I was very much in favor of. But, you know, if a horse had broken out of Churchill Downs, it would be a huge deal, but obviously a huger deal if it happens in Santa Anita. I mean, my goodness, what the hell is going to happen? And what is the firestorm going to be? And again, it's like, I hate to bring this up and, like, you know, just put the, you know, black cloud over this podcast. But, you know, I guess one thing is I hope racing is prepared for this and knows, you know, I guess Craig Fravel would probably be the person in his last go at the Breeders' Cup that would have to come out and, you know, be the spokesman for this. But I hope they, and I bet they have, that they prepared for this and how they're going to handle it. But, man, it's a scary thing.
One thing I thought was interesting, I think it was last week, the CHRB made an announcement that their meeting, I think it was late October, was canceled because of they couldn't get enough board members there. I don't know all the details at all, but it was kind of surprising to see that before this absolutely huge week for California racing that they wouldn't have a meeting.
Anymore. Inexplicable.
I mean, maybe, you know, we don't know the whole story, but it was kind of surprising to see.
Yeah. I mean, it was a commissioner availability is
right.
What they said.
They couldn't, yeah. Jeez.
All right. I'm going to shift gears a little bit here. Al brought something up. It was interesting. And Bill has harped on this a lot in the paper, and we haven't talked about it on the podcast yet. Going back to the gambling discussion that we were having last week about takeout, similar but different. We're going to talk about late odds drops, which is something that I think drives horse players nuts. It's not always in that direction. Occasionally, I feel like it's much less frequently, at least with horses I bet. Occasionally, you'll bet, and you'll get a better price after the gates open. Usually, it's the other way around. Usually, you're getting half the price you thought you were, and it just leaves a sour taste in your mouth. Even if you cash the ticket, it makes you feel crappy. Al, go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, I don't do as much betting as those sitting to my right, immediate right, and further to the right. I guess when Keeneland comes around, I get a little more juiced up. So I had a bet last week on Alexandra in the Buffalo Trace Franklin County Stakes, and she loaded 9-5. I watched the race. She won the race. Bry says to me, "Oh, you got 5-2. I'm like, "Oh, really? 5-2? So, I mean, great. I thought I was getting, you know, 560. I got $7 even. Then on Monday, Joe and I watched the Knickerbocker with both fans of LeCullen. He was 3-1 walking into the stalls. And by the time they hit the first turn, Joe says, "Hey, look at that. He got crushed." And he's 3-2. So instead of $7 or $8, we got $5.10. Got the breakage, Joe.
Yeah, that 10 cents was huge.
But so I'm not suggesting there's anything diabolical or that this is a pass posting issue, like you said, Bri, but there is a certain level of frustration when I don't know how to stop it. I mean, I don't know if you close betting with a window with a minute to go before they go in the gate, or I don't know how you address that problem.
Yeah, and it's the only betting game that I can think of where that happens, where you don't have a set price that you know that you're getting. Like, imagine if you bet the NFL and you're betting the team like delay 7 points. And then the game starts and it's only 3.5. Like, you would walk out of the sports book in furor and anger. And just, it's not a good look at all. You know, I think we have a lot of things that we talk about that aren't good looks for racing. This is a big deal that I think not enough people talk about. And I know Bill's chopping at the bit to talk about it.
Well, thank you. Yes, it is a huge...
He's staring a hole through me or something.
It is a huge deal. And Alan, to explain what happens here is that it's not pass posting. It's that these huge bettors, these computer guys who have their algorithms, they will see that horse at 3-1 that you said and say, "Wait a minute, you know, so what is that? Like, the horse has a 25% chance of winning at 3-1. Yep. This horse has a 50% chance of winning, according to our computer programs." So then they're able to bet at the very last second. You know, they have special access into the pools, and it's very complicated and it's very shadowy, and I don't know, you know, all of what goes on, but this is what explains these sort of drops. And, you know, Alan, and Joe, you said this too, and I said this, it's the only game in town where you can win a bet and be pissed off afterwards. Now, okay, so what do we do about it? These guys aren't breaking any rules. They deserve, I mean, they're smarter than we are, because I can't sit at a computer and write a program that's going to tell me that, you know, Code of Honor should really be 2-1 in the Breeders' Cup, and he's going off at 4-1. So now I'm going to bet, you know, $1 million on him. So they deserve the fruits of their labors. But, you know, it's terrible for everybody else. And Alan, you know, like, you know, you're a diehard. You'll never quit racing. But, you know, somebody who bet on that horse from 3-1 to 3-2, very well say, like, "This is BS. Mm-hmm. You know, this is no good. I'm going to, you know, and walk over to the, you know, Resorts World Casino. And, well, I know that the slot machines aren't rigged, but I don't know that about racing." Now, what do we do about it? You know, there is no easy answer, and the tracks are never going to tell these guys they can't bet. Maybe if, you know, they shut the windows a minute to post, might leave a little bit better taste in everybody's mouth, but they're never going to do that. And they're never going to turn down these guys' money. So I think this opens up the whole discussion of, is it time for racing to get serious about the idea of fixed odds wagering? And, you know, the Thoroughbred Idea Foundation, Pat Cummings and them, you know, are on that wavelength and have been talking about that. But, you know, again, it's one of those pipe dreams. It's not going to happen, and really nothing's going to be done about it.
Well, Brian's a bettor on the Betfair Exchange. I mean, do you bet almost exclusively on that now, or?
I try to. I mean, if you have the option to bet both, you should definitely be betting the exchange. A lot of tracks aren't offered on there yet, so it's still, you know, the Kentucky tracks or New York, you still need to bet on the tote. I'm not as upset by the odds changes. I don't know why. I mean, it's a parimutuel game. Sometimes it goes in your favor, sometimes it doesn't.
But doesn't it seem like you never are on the right side of it? Yeah, you're the first guy I've ever heard.
To me, that's like,
guys are never wrong.
I think their programs probably tend to favor front runners, so you sort of see it more in those examples.
Could be, yeah.
I don't know. I mean, it goes both ways. I think parimutuel wagering is still, in some ways, the best form of wagering. Obviously, the technology could be better. I think a big part of it is I'm sure the pools could update quicker with more updated technology, and I think that's probably the biggest issue. But I'm all for fixed odds. You know, I think that's definitely, from a bettor's perspective, probably the way to go a lot of times.
Now, the problem with Betfair, though, is that it's only available to people in New Jersey, and, you know, they just take a bunch of crap tracks. I mean, they got a couple decent signals, like Woodbine and Monmouth isn't too bad, but you left out California. They have no California, no Kentucky, no New York. So right there, you just obliterated the three most important racetracks in the country. And, you know, I don't know what their business is.
Well, I think a lot of that has to do with the regulators more than I'm sure Betfair would love, because they take I'm pretty sure they take bets from New York tracks overseas.
Yeah, but not in the US.
They can't,
yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, also, go ahead.
They've been trying to, I think for a couple of years, been trying to get Kentucky tracks, and I think it didn't get approved. You know, I could be wrong, but I'm pretty sure it didn't get approved by the KHRC or whoever oversees that.
Right, and it's like kind of hard to get off the ground, because I've heard you say before that a lot of times it's hard because there's not enough liquidity to really make any big money, because there aren't enough people to match your price at the amounts you want.
It's tough at the really small tracks. It's tough if you wanted to bet, you know, Mountaineer on a Monday. You can't really bet more than a few bucks. But the bigger tracks, Woodbine has pretty good liquidity. And on the days, the big racing days when there are a lot of European horses, it's great because you know you're commingled with European bettors, and the pools are pretty big.
Gotcha. One last thing we wanted to touch on. This is a discussion that we've been wanting to have for a while, but there's been too much news, a little bit of a lull now. We're going to talk about how we make rising stars at the TDN. A lot of people care a shocking amount, frankly, about horses becoming TDN rising stars. And, you know, it's not something we take lightly, and we realize that we're flattered, honestly, that people care. And we just wanted to give you like a little bit of an inside look as to our discussions and how we make these designations. I think it's a little bit different for everybody. I think there's no set criteria, really. It's not like we have a list up on the wall in the office of bullet points of what horses have to match certain criteria. So I'll just start with me, and then Brian and Al can add on to this. For me, I tend to give horses more credence who are doing things earlier in their career. You know, if it's a late developing 3-year-old debuting in September or October, I think I'm going to give that less credence than maybe a 2-year-old a year earlier, or a 3-year-old in January or February. And I got an example of a horse that I think has the talent of a rising star, but we didn't make one. And that was in Sunday's first race at Belmont. It was a horse named Bridalwood Cat, Jonathan Thomas trainee, pretty expensive, $750,000 daughter of Street Sense. She debuted at Tampa in March, going two turns, didn't do much running, came back off of a layoff Sunday at Belmont, and ran off to like a 12-length win, ran 109-1, really impressive performance. But for me, you got to think of the context. She's a 3-year-old, late in her 3-year-old year, debuted once at a lesser track, and then wasn't seen again for 7 months. There's no doubting the ability she has. She showed that on Sunday. But I think in terms of projecting forward what the horse is going to do going forward, I think you have to take that context into account and think, how likely is this horse to stay on the track? How likely is this horse to step up in a graded stakes company? And there's a lot of context involved with that. But also you think about, you know, it's a visual thing. Sometimes there are some horses that just look like better travelers. You have to take the field that they beat into account. You have to take the pace scenario, the final time. So there's a ton of stuff that we factor in, and we don't always get it right, but I think overall we do a pretty good job of weighing all the factors and making our decisions based on that.
I think we should note that the definition of a TDN rising star, it's a horse that we think is going to go on to win a graded stake. Mm-hmm. You know, I think we all look at a lot of the same stuff. I think there are certain trainers who, I mean, maybe this isn't the best way to say it, but we've kind of gotten burned by before. They'll have horses win and we'll, you know, maybe we've made a couple rising stars for them and then they didn't really pan out. And I think we'd be less likely to make another horse from that trainer rising star. It's tough. The one that I'm kind of kicking myself for this year was Dunbar Road. I remember the race. It was like a Sunday. It was Gulfstream early in the card. It just didn't look like a particularly tough race. The favorite was a Jorge Navarro horse that I don't think has panned out. And most of the field hasn't panned out. And I think one other horse behind her has. The reality is it's tough to do this. And I think anyone who's in the horse business knows how unpredictable it is. And you have a lot of information and you really still don't know anything. And, you know, we do our best. And I think we have a higher than average strike rate, but it's still a guessing game.
Yeah. By definition, it's a subjective exercise. And I think each one of us sort of tests our own ability to make the right call. And you know, we much prefer to get it right than we do get it wrong. Occasionally, we'll have a horse that we just can't make a rising star. American Pharoah wins his maiden in the Del Mar Futurity. We're kind of beat.
Mm-hmm.
We got it right with Justify. Rachel Alexander was not a TDN rising star until she really exploded on the scene. She hadn't really done anything to distinguish herself otherwise. Zenyatta was a TDN rising star.
That was the Thanksgiving Day race, right?
That was a Thanksgiving Day race.
Yeah.
Not one of us here did that.
No.
Street Sense was a TDN rising star. I'd like to toot my own horn on that.
Okay.
Off of a very narrow Arlington synthetic maiden win. But that was one of my more rewarding ones. But it is flattering to see that it's really become a brand, mm-hmm. and something that, you know, advertisers don't hesitate to use it in their campaigns.
Yeah, I see it on commercials.
Right?
Yeah.
You hear sales, a lot,
sales
too.
Sales companies don't hesitate to say TDN Rising Star. So, yeah. So, you know, it's cool when somebody calls up from such and such farm and says, hey, is that one going to be a TDN Rising Star? And chances are we've thought about doing it.
Yeah.
Either the answer is yes or no, but it is flattering.
It's cool until they start leaning on you.
Yeah, I was going to say, then cool, it's not, cool is one
then it's
one
not
word
great. Let's not encourage the trying to work the refs here. Yeah, because we certainly get plenty of that.
Well, being the only one in the room that doesn't contribute to deciding who would be a TDN Rising Star, I'm going to kind of switch hats here and be the interrogator, so to speak. I'd be interested to know the process. If you guys are working, is it one person's opinion just says, okay, this horse just ran off the screen, you know, $1 million yearling at Saratoga, you know, kind of like no-brainer type things. Brian or Alan, would you just, you know, make that decision yourself, or do you have to huddle with the other people in the office and have to get a consensus?
I think with the really obvious ones, we don't even really consult anyone. We'll just go ahead and do it. You know, like you said, the $1 million horse at Saratoga winning by 10, we don't really need to talk to the rest of the group. Otherwise, I think we're all kind of watching the races as they're happening anyways. And then we'll kind of, whoever's in charge that day of making that decision, we'll kind of ask everybody else to take a look, and then we'll go over it. We'll talk. Someone might look up the pedigree. We'll, you know, if we have a clocker report, we'll look that up. We might look up a trainer stat, compare times. That's one thing that's a little tricky. It's tough to compare times in the middle of a card when you've got a million other things going on. You maybe didn't watch the starter allowance and the maiden 30 that happened the two races before that at Belmont. And, you know, we don't have the luxury of having the figures or knowing what the variant's going to be. So that part can be tricky. But I'd say generally it's a team effort.
Yeah, and it's the most important thing is it's really about context. You know, was the horse well bet? We can sometimes see workout reports. Was the horse working with somebody good? You know, like I said, the dynamics of the race, who was in the field. As long as we're beating our chests about rising stars. I started at TDN in February 2016, and the first rising star that I made the call on, and Brian was there, and he was like, go for it, was Arrogate.
Big A,
yeah.
All right.
Yeah, so I was pretty happy about that one.
What a good start, wow.
Still only bet like 20 bucks on him at 11-1 at the Travers, so yeah. It's not like I got rich off him, but yeah, so that was a good start for me.
I think mine was Uncle Mo on a Travers day, but it was because nobody else was in the office yet, and they left the poor rookie there. But
yeah.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt there. I want to also ask, I mean, because it's fascinating, because this has become, you know, so important to people, And, you know, people are using it in their advertising campaigns, like you said, and everything. Do you guys feel pressure? Like, you know, this is not something like, oh, by the way, you know, it's no big deal. And everybody's going to say, oh, isn't that nice? Like, I mean, it's a decision now that, you know, really affects a lot of things. You know, and there is a lot of pressure for you guys to get it right. I mean, do you feel that? Like, is it a little less fun because of that?
I mean, there's definitely pressure. But I think the key is you just have to have a sound argument.
Yeah.
And like I kind of said, if you're in the horse business, you know it's not an exact science. You know that, you know, I'm sure, you know, everyone's been fooled 9 times out of 10, and it's never easy. There's definitely some pressure, though.
It's been interesting because at times people say, or we are asked as a staff to lay out the argument against, mostly against. People want to know why their horse that went off by 7 was not made a Rising Star. And, you know, like Joe said, there are variables. It's, you know, a combination of time and pedigree and, you know. But personally, I like to see the horse do something extraordinary, whether that's from fast time or they covered 40 extra feet or just something, or they split horses or they fought on gamely inside and came back at the rail with somebody lapped on their outside the entire race or something like that. So, but I would say yes, there's a certain amount of pressure, more or less because, I mean, I feel it's sort of self-imposed. I just, every time I make a Rising Star, I want to get it right.
Yeah.
And I've had bad ones as well, by the way.
Yeah. Never.
And it's...
So I'm sure then, with that explanation that you've given me, I'm sure Maximum Security did not get Rising Star status after Baker's
well,
Bay
for 30. Even, that race well, didn't even come in, I don't think.
Yeah,
that's the thing. Right, occasionally yeah. there are
Kelly
races
Kip,
you don't
however.
See.
Kelly yeah. Kip.
Oh, yeah, I think okay.
World, that's of Trouble, World of Trouble was another one where he won in a maiden claimer first out and yeah. wouldn't have even
yeah.
seen it.
Yeah.
I'll say I think certain trainers, it's harder. Like Chad Brown, it's tough to know. All his horses kind of run the same way. They're all well-bred. They're all expensive. They all make that big finishing move, and it's kind of tough to separate and figure out. I mean, they're the ones who are just so brilliant that you have to do it, that it's obvious. But, you know, he could have, if we made every one of his horses a Rising Star, he'd have 100 Rising Stars by the end of the year.
Right. Baffert's like that, too.
Baffert, yeah, too. How do you yeah. separate them?
Yeah, and it's just, again, it's about context and variables, and you know that Bob Baffert's horses are going to be cranked to run first time out all the time, but that doesn't necessarily mean that they're going to go on the same way a Justify will.
Right. And then, too, we have our European team who designates the European Rising Stars and, you know, Frankel and horses like that. They have a very good strike rate as well. We've had Rising Stars in Japan. We've had Golden Slipper winners that were Rising Stars in Australia. We've had Grade One winners, a Group One winners in Hong Kong. So it's not just America. We keep an eye on what's going on everywhere.
Mm-hmm. All right, so that's it for this week's episode of the TDN Writers Room. We will see you next week when we have the Breeders' Cup pre-entries, and then things will start to ramp up as we get towards the Breeders' Cup. I want to thank Bill Finley, Alan Carrasso, Brian DiDonato. This is Joe Bianca signing off. See you next week.